start and thank you for joining us to discuss implications of the global financial crisis for fragile states, fragile and conflict-affected states. My name is Raymond Gilpin. I direct the Institute's work on sustainable economies. And these days, looking at the global financial environment, the word sustainable economies is not one that would spring readily to mind. But what we want to do today is take a look at what we know about the financial crisis, and then see how the ripple effects of the crisis do or do not affect fragile states, and then discuss a range of policy options and strategies for these states and their development partners. Since the initial tremors of the financial crisis were felt last August, September, we've seen a lot of discussion about the impacts and implications across the globe. We've been privy to a slew of bewildering statistics, 40% of stock value loss, final effects, financial sector credit effects, probably topping $1.4 trillion US dollar equivalent, significant job losses and business failures. But we do know a lot about the magnitude, although there is some uncertainty. But in terms of the impact, broadly, we do have some clarity that we're going to have tighter credits, we're going to have flagging growth, we'll probably have unemployment and business failures. And so we have a pretty broad idea of how the financial crisis is going to impact industrialized and emerging economies. We know a bit more about developing economies, but we know a lot less about the fragile and conflict-affected states, those states that occupy the now-famed bottom billion. But we have a very able panel this morning to help us think through these issues. You have their bios in your handout, so I wouldn't go through an exhaustive introduction. The first speaker will be Louis Dix Miro, who is Deputy Division Chief for Development Issues at the IMF. Next would be Gilles Alfandori, my former colleague from the debt relief days at the World Bank. He's currently a senior economist in the Africa department, but he used to lead a lot of work in the low-income countries under stress, like us unit at the World Bank. And third, and by no means last, is one of the most active retirees in the region, Willene Johnson. She has a very extensive and impressive resume, but one thing that I'd mention is the fact that in addition to being president of Comasa Inc., her consulting concern, she's also a full-time and practicing farmer down in Southern Virginia. How she manages to balance all these things, I would never know. The game plan is to have brief remarks by the three panelists and then engage you, comments and questions. We're going to try to make them pointed and direct, and so we have as much interaction as possible. If you have anything that rings, buzzes, stings, vibrates at this point, it's a good idea to turn it off because it does affect our audio equipment here at the Institute. So if you could please do us a favor of turning them off now, and I can assure you they'll be back on at or around 2 p.m. Having said that, let me invite our first speaker, Louis, to introduce the topic and give us a broad overview of the relationship between the crisis and fragile states.
Thank you very much. I must say, by the time I finished working on my notes, I felt like I ought to go back to the beginning and start rewriting them. And the only sort of hope for me was the fact that today's presentation was on a Monday, and hopefully not too much could happen over the weekend. So, let's move on to slide one. Raymond asked me to give a brief overview of what's happening in the financial markets and the financial crisis. For those of you who read the paper, you'll see it's gradually morphing and spreading, but let's go back to the beginning. It began, let me just stress first, this is a major crisis. You know, it's the worst we've seen in advanced countries since the 1930s. It's caused major disruptions in financial institutions in the US and Europe. The turbulence is spreading to emerging markets, and its consequences are going to be felt in the real economy of not only the advanced but also the developing countries. Next slide. Now, what sort of the financial sector is experiencing extreme stress from a number of sources now. Confidence and trust in and among financial institutions has evaporated as distressed assets, as holdings of securities of subprime mortgages led to write-downs, losses, and weakened balance sheets. As a result, credit markets froze. Banks would not lend to each other, and depositors and investors withdrew their funds or did not renew lines of credit. There's been some easing in the last week, and heavily leveraged institutions have been forced into abrupt and disorderly deleveraging. In other words, selling assets at low prices to redeem deposits and rebuild their capital base. The sources for funding their operations have also dried up as a result of heightened risk aversion and uncertainties about their solvency. If we go through the next few slides, you'll see some of these indicators. Of course, they're all a bit out of date, and most of them will probably look worse, but some have improved by now. Next one. And this is the stock market, which has continued in a certain direction. Next one. And this is, you can see how things have progressed in the past. This was 2006. This map is based on a weighted average of 7 indicators of financial stress, covering interest rate spreads, volatility, and portfolio beta risk. Beta measure. Next one. Now we see it's gradually getting worse. And then next one. And here we are, all high tech is spread. Now what's missing there are the emerging markets. And if we move on to the next slide, you can see what's happening. This was, if I had it up to date now, it would look even worse right now. You can see it's spread increasingly. Shall we move on to the next slide? Now, the financial crisis spilled over into the real economy, dampening growth. And there are several channels in which growth has been affected. A drop in housing prices has led consumers cutting back on spending. Credit to households has tightened. Borrowing by companies has become more difficult. And as a result, there's a negative feedback loop into expectations of growth that have declined. And this has reinforced the decline in asset prices as profit expectations have fallen. And consumer and business sentiment are both leading to lower spending and investment that would fuel growth. Now, emerging markets, it's a slightly different phenomenon. They're experiencing portfolio outflows, the cutback in credit lines by foreign investors because of funding needs in their home countries. for example, hedge funds have experienced a very large withdrawal of their funds and they're having to pay them off, and they're liquidating assets in emerging markets. And also concerns about, and with that, concerns about emerging markets' ability to honour external debts and bank loans falling due. And this again has led to doubts about financial corporate sector soundness in the emerging markets. And this has had a knock-on effect with rapidly depreciating exchange rates, decline in reserves, shortages of funds, and they're also declining export and growth outlooks, prospects, especially related to commodity price drops and development in advanced economies. Next slide. There's just two indicators of confidence. As you can see, it's way back in September. Now, in the past week or two, as you will all know, the financial stress has intensified in emerging markets in Eastern Europe, the Baltics, Latin America, and even China and India are showing signs of a slowdown in growth. And so that's, you know, what's happening in the financial markets. Now, before I go ahead and talk about what the prospects are for the global economy and how this all feeds into fragile states and post-conflict countries, I think it's important that while this seminar is focused on the financial crisis, you know, the headwinds of this crisis come on the heels of the food and fuel crisis. Mm-hmm. Next slide. And many in emerging and developing economies, especially net and food and fuel importers, are still grappling with the fiscal and balance of payments and poverty effects of the food and fuel crisis. Now, even though food and fuel prices have eased in recent months, they still, certainly for food, remain well above the levels in 2006. And why don't we move on to slide 12 and 13. Well, there you can see commodity futures. There you can see projected prices. Probably metals have dropped even further than that forecast, and energy has certainly. If we go on to 13. I can't see anything. Can anyone else?
This is uncertainty.
Well, it's a rather nifty picture because the right-hand panel is supposed to show you the IMF forecasts for futures prices for oil, crude oil. And it's supposed to show you the median, the midpoint, the mean expectation, and then the various confidence intervals. So while the midpoint, when this was done, was about $100 per barrel, the uncertainty range, if you wanted to be 90% sure that you got the price forecast right, you could forecast the price anywhere between $160 and $55. And as of this morning, we were at 60.
Yep.
So, shall we now? Let's go on to the next slide. Based on, you know, a recent IMF study published in September, you know, some 50 developing countries remained at risk. They were already struggling this year, but they will remain at risk with less than adequate reserves through 2009 as a result of the food and fuel price increase. And there you have this, and there you have a picture of it. Let me skip over the various, well, let me give you some sense of the figures. 58 net fuel importing
low-income countries face a rise in their import bill of $60 billion, or the equivalent of 3.2% of GDP in 2008. 43 net food importers face a rise in their food bill of $7 billion, 0.8%. So about the famous effect of the food crisis, is less. And 24 countries, the combined fiscal cost from rising food and fuel subsidies is expected to exceed 2% of GDP. Right? That's money that could be spent elsewhere on other needs. And many of them have experienced a substantial acceleration in inflation to 13% on average by end 2008. We all know inflation affects the poorest the most. Let's move on, and we'll look at what this all means for the global economy. Now, in early October, the IMF projected a slowdown in growth of 3.9% to 2.8%, with zero growth in advanced economies. Virtually all the growth was going to come from emerging and developing economies. The Fed of 16, 17 and 18, just go through that very quickly. So you can see it's cooling down. Now, it's based on several assumptions. The US market, housing market would bottom out in 2009. Policies would succeed in restoring more normal financial markets. And emerging markets could continue to be a source of resilience. But there's a lot of uncertainty in this slide, as you can see. And especially now, this is very important because how much resilience we can expect from the emerging markets is coming increasingly into doubt. And that's important. Think about this. In 2007, Brazil, Russia, India and China contributed 40% to global growth. While lower than expected oil prices will provide some boost, it will also see net fuel importers and also impact export and growth prospects of fuel exporters. So, what are the implications, next slide, for fragile and post-conflict countries? Well, it's going to hurt fragile states and post-conflict through a number of channels. Low growth will induce negative effects on commodity prices, exports, remittances, tourism, and possibly over time, aid and private sector contributions, philanthropic institutions. Lower foreign direct investment, especially with lower commodity prices, making such investment less profitable. Of less importance are the direct financial effects, which are briefly listed there, largely because they don't have access to capital markets and they're not that integrated into the global financial system. So you don't see big international banks with lots of operations there. Next slide. That said, you know, what are the implications for fragile states? Fragile states are very different. There's a lot of diversity, so it's hard to sort of say this is the average picture, because it would be very misleading. Now, commodity price volatility has been very high, and recent price falls are likely to help lower inflation in many countries. But the effects on the terms of trade and current account may be negative for others, like metal and fuel exporters. The second factor is likely to be of less importance, if any, in fragile states, unless you want to call Nigeria and Kenya, Ghana fragile states. Recent commodity price declines and turmoil in investing companies may reduce foreign direct investment flows, and this could eventually be important for some companies. I noticed in the Washington Post on Friday, they quoted President Sterling Johnson saying that there are a couple of major projects and major FDI inflows that were likely to be deferred and delayed. And then there are other sorts of negative spillovers that you see there. And there's the ongoing vulnerability to high end food and fuel prices. Now this poses, next slide, difficult challenges. And I'll just go through them quickly, many of them. One is they still need to complete the necessary phase adjustment to higher food and fuel prices. That's going to be easier in the case of fuel prices now. There's often a lot of divergence between local prices and world market prices. To help the food crisis is a long-term one, and they have to start renewing support for agricultural development. Some countries will need to take additional efforts to control inflation and rein in current account deficits. Measures to protect the poor need to be better targeted to reduce their unsustainable fiscal costs. And then there needs to be contingency plans in the event of any drop-off in aid and decline in external and fiscal revenues through the global slowdown in growth. Now these challenges, next slide, are particularly hard for fragile states and post-conflict countries. They already have lower per capita, income per capita and growth rates than other countries. Food accounts for a large share of household spending. There's a limited domestic revenue base and low reserves level with which to offset possible declines in external financing. Dependence on limited sources of external financing like donor aid, will that be effective? Many commodity dependent countries will face lower export and fiscal revenues that may require difficult adjustments just as external financing may be becoming scarcer, more expensive. At the same time, we still have the long-standing large spending needs for reconstruction and to alleviate very low, high poverty levels. They have weak technical capacity and delivery systems that hamper efforts to better target safety nets and improve efficiency of spending. The need to restrain inflation in some countries may limit the scope for bank financing and fiscal spending. And all of this is done in an environment of social and political fragility and high expectations, the classic peace dividend. And the government has difficult spending choices in this environment when there are limited resources to make, with which to make trade-offs and choices between and also cut back in different types of government spending. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Louis.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Since I don't have slides, maybe I want to piggyback on Louis' slides. If you could put me on page 14, just the map as a background. So when we look at these questions, and Raymond asked me to look a bit at the diversity of case, I think there's a macroeconomic approach to the question, which is basically, and Louis went over quite in detail, what is the impact of the turmoil specifically on developing countries, and from that, what affects other states? And I'm going to go back on some of the cases, but I think that what the main point I want to come that is actually pretty evident that the impact is not obvious. But I would go beyond that. I would say that the concept of fragile space actually is so diverse that it's almost, it will group such a diversity of countries that it's almost impossible to draw a conclusion about macroeconomic shock and fragile space. And the reason for that is that the concept itself was defined as an answer to a political, not a macroeconomic issue. And that will be the second part of my remarks, where I believe that basically there is a possible serious impact that going through the political dimension of the question and the question of assistance and the question of commitments of the welfare country in their focus in assisting fragile states. So, if I go back very briefly on the macroeconomic impacts, and I'm just basing remarks on some work we did, it's mostly focused on Africa, and it's based on a remark our chief economist, Shantali Varian, prepared recently in trying to look at what is relevant for fragile states. Well, banking systems are unlikely to experience the turbulence of high-income economies. You said it. We do have exceptions because within the fragile states, some countries are more exposed to rising private sector growth, and that's still the case for Nigeria and Ivory Coast. Here again, we can question the concept of fragile states. Are Nigeria and Ivory Coast typical fragile states? Or are they developing economies with local crises which at some point put them in the limelight of the international community? If we look at Ivory Coast, for instance, 66% of the banking assets are held by Société Générale in France, which we know was affected before the general turmoil and continues to be affected, right? But most of the countries in Africa which have a significant concentration of foreign banks are by definition not fragile. They are among the most performing of the developing economies. If we look recently at what happened in these economies, you have significant credit growth. 117% growth in 2007 in Nigeria and 62% in Ivory Coast. So these two economies are going to face a situation where access to credit, which was becoming important, is probably going to reverse. Is it true for the rest of the economies in fragile states? No. If we look at the rest of private capital inflows, portfolio inflow is insignificant, absolutely. FDI is more significant for some economies, but here again it varies a lot. If you look at the distribution of FDI in Africa, for instance, we find a country like Chad with almost 4% of the African FDI, mostly linked to the pipeline, so one big project FDI. We find that Nigeria has 30% of the FDI in Africa. Okay, so very large concentration of the FDI on a few spot countries, while most of the fragile states are actually former aid orphans completely forgotten. Now, even if private inflows are small, they could have dramatic impact on securities prices when you have exchange rates. And again, we find Nigeria and we find Ivory Coast with regional stock exchange. So some of the typical channel and mechanism you see happen in very few countries. But for most of the countries we're talking about, you know, and Louis said it, concessional and non-concessional official flows, investment and remittances are really key. And this is where we can look at the potential impacts of the financial turmoil. Well, investment proposal, when we basically look now at Western or international companies, the increase in risk aversion that we observe is basically deluding many of them from exploring opportunities in emerging markets and even more so in these type of countries. basically it goes against intuition, where in a world where you have more positive correlation across your financial assets and everybody's losing, you will be tempted to look for exotic assets with negative correlation in order to improve the overall return of your portfolio. However, what happens is that most of the investors in the world are basically lacking cash, need to sell indiscriminately low return and better return assets to generate the cash they need, and basically don't have the financial means these days to do extra investments called exotic. So the appetite for diversification has actually decreased, even though you have, as is the case often during a financial crisis, the convergence of the correlation among a broad set of assets at the exclusion maybe of gold these days. In addition to investment from Western countries, more important in the latter years was investment from China directly and a few countries from India. And that's the big issue. That's the big question for the future. I don't think we know very well what's going to happen. Commitment infrastructure project in Africa from China totaled $7 billion in 2006. That's quite significant. Even with the growth slowing down from 10% to a comfortable 7%, right? In theory, China would still have the means to continue to invest massively in these type of countries. I don't think we have very much visibility now about what China is going to do. But if FDI were us to be sustained over time, China will have a key role there. Okay, now looking at remittances. Well, remittances is absolutely critical. In many of our countries, not to say most of our countries, remittances count for more than official development assistance and FDI combined. And this is probably where most of the impact is going to take place, since remittances is generated by jobs in the countries which by definition are not fragile, but are directly affected by the financial crisis, either as developing economies or as emerging markets. Increased unemployment, lower growth will affect revenue and earning, but that's less likely the case now because the international community has responded rapidly. A disruption in the international payment system could have compromised remittances. I don't think now we're going to have that extreme scenario. But a couple of weeks ago, when we started seeing the collapse of Lehman and then additional banks, one after the other, these issues were on the table. They might come back on the table down the line if things are really getting messy. In any case, remittances are important for economies, but are poorly taxed, therefore have not such a direct impact on the budget. Okay, they have a tremendous impact on poverty and poverty alleviation. Then the next key channel is really official flows, concessional or non-concessional. Here I would like to believe, maybe because I worked on these issues several years ago, that we have made progress in terms of aid predictability, that the Paris Declaration and the London Declaration for Fragile States have helped stabilize commitments of ODA to developing economies and fragile states for the next 2 or 3 years. And I would like to believe that budgetary stress in developed economies are not going to translate immediately into lower level of assistance. But even if I'm right, the question is going to be asked 2-3 years down the line. Even if, if we look back at IDA 15, for instance, which did perform tremendously well in comparison to the IDA 14 replenishment, right, with a surge in the envelope for fragile states, we are quite protected in this area for the moment. As the time comes to negotiation for IDA 16, then everything is back on the table and everything will depend on the fiscal capacity of IDA deputies. And that's true for IDA, but that's true for many other institutions. And that's very true if you look at bilateral assistance. So if you look at growth forecast, and I think it appeared very clearly in some of your charts, Louis, even than 2009 or 2010, the prospects are not that good. Now, on the upside, what we do see is that we have new contributors to ODA. The industrializing countries which are now industrialized, we all have China in mind, but it's true of other countries as well. So the set of countries contributing to ODA is now increasing, and it might be that we have less ODA coming from the West, but more coming from less traditional donors as well. Okay. Now, we have the demand impact, and we have the price impact. I mean, the demand impact is very clear, recession, less demand, not favorable to export. Okay. Most of our countries are very small countries. They're price takers. A drop in world demand is less likely to have an impact in the way that the volume they export are very small compared to world demand. Let's look now at the prices, right? We have a complete diversity of countries across the board, whether you're energy exporters, main commodity exporters. And as we put it, since the main cause of stress was really food and energy before the financial crisis, the immediate impact of the crisis is actually positive in many of these countries. Unless you're an oil exporting country, okay, you're benefiting on several levels. Your energy bill is less important. Your imports are cheaper, partly for food, which was a critical area for these countries. If you look now at the exchange rate systems, right, half of the fragile states countries in Africa are basically on the CFA fund system, so linked to the euro. And were penalized tremendously over the last 2-3 years by the appreciation of the euro, so their currency against the US dollar. To the point that actually the real appreciation in their currency until recently, compared to level observed in 1994, just before the devaluation of the French CFA. So what we now observe is really an oxygen tank with a tightening of the dollar against the euro. That's a major impact, and that's probably much more important than the negative impact of lower commodity prices on their exports. Not true for all oil exporting economies. Right, so I mean, to sum up a bit on the macroeconomic impact, if you're not an oil exporter, you might be in the short and medium run doing a bit better off. And as long as you maintain your ODA, you basically have terms of trade shock reversed in favor of your economy. So the real concern now is looking forward, right? And that brings me maybe to the other part of my remarks, which is, what is it to be a fragile state? I mean, being a fragile state, it's really about rebuilding the state. It's about the consolidation of the state. In the several fragile states on which I worked, the issue was not so much whether their export, whether they were diamonds or cotton or whatever, were going to be absorbed by the West, but whether the custom systems were able to tax proceeds from the sale, bring it back to the budget, whether the government had the capacity to plan for education and health spending based on these media revenues. Okay. There isn't anything in the financial crisis now which is really affecting that dimension. What is affecting it is that the progress we have observed over the last few years in terms of the fragile states government built that capacity came a lot from assistance from the international community, both in terms of dollar monies and in terms of warm bodies. Okay? And so the question here really is, and in the context of Glenigal, where the international community has had a very hard time to deliver on Glenigal's commitments, whether the international community is going to continue to focus
on partial state assistance, despite the stress that they would face with their parliament, with their public opinion, with an increase in taxes, with an increase in inflation, with more difficulty to get all this deployment of people and resources approved in parliament. I would like to believe that what we observe in the last couple of weeks, which is a coordinated response of the rich country to face the financial crisis. I mean, a response which did not start in a coordinated way, but which really got coordinated over the last weeks, is a good indication that the international committee might have learned a lesson over the last decade or so, and might apply the same reasoning towards partial state, in the way that disengaging now would be a recipe for failure. If we look back at the literature on partial states, we see people like Paul Collier and others have looked at to a long extent. The outcome and the results in development assistance in fragile states is there if you commit it for 10 years in a row at least and in significant volume. There is absolutely no point in these countries for stop and go type of assistance. That's actually the main recipe for failure, because you don't have time to build structure, you don't have time to consolidate the states. So sustaining this type of level of assistance and the type of assistance is absolutely critical to get results over time. And it's absolutely critical that this type of commitment is not affected by the fiscal situation in donor countries. I think that's I will leave it there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I'd actually also like to thank the other two presenters for raising and in some cases quantifying many of the issues that I would like to look at. I've been asked to look at the issues of trade and aid as they relate to fragile states. But I would actually like to start with a definition of an alternative definition of fragility. I think that we have spoken some about the fragile state concept as it is currently used by the World Bank and the IMF. I'd like to define it for you and then move on to talk about extending it to a more purely economic measure that I think will be helpful in terms of assessing what is going on and how we can assist states that have a certain vulnerability and, as you mentioned, an institutional capacity weakness. But I'd also like to mention the transformations in trade that have occurred in the last decade. Speak of what we need to do to improve our partnerships. Unfortunately, they aren't necessarily better than they have been in the recent, although they may be better, they're not good enough. And speak about what we need to do to sustain development. Now, the World Bank does have a definition of fragile states that is also used by the International Monetary Fund. That definition focuses on economic policy and economic policy institutions. The bank identifies the fragile states in terms of their ranking in the country policy and institutional assessment measure, so that those countries that are in the bottom two quintiles of this category are judged to be fragile in that their capacity to provide services through the normal structures of governance are weaker than that of other countries in the system. So state policies and institutions are weak. They are therefore vulnerable In their capacity, they find difficulty in delivering services to citizens, they find difficulty in controlling corruption, and they slide into the kind of negative feedback roles that have been described here this morning. From the perspective of those of us who are interested in peace in the world, these countries also face a higher probability of conflict. And even though part of their fragility results from past conflicts, in the case of Cote d'Ivoire, for example, but there definitely is a link, an interrelationship between political and political insecurity, conflict, and economic or political fragility. What I'd like to do is turn very briefly to a concept that is currently used by the United Nations, and that is the concept of economic vulnerability. The Economic Vulnerability Index is one of three indices that is used by the Committee for Development Policy to designate those countries in the world that are least developed. And by that, the UN means those set of countries that face structural impediments to economic development and growth, and therefore need targeted assistance in order to actually move into a development, a positive development cycle. The Economic Vulnerability Index, rather than looking at policy institutions, is a measure of vulnerability to trade shocks and shocks from natural disasters. And I won't go into details of this, but the details of the index are on the UN website in the Committee for Development Policy. But it basically relates to the profile of economic activity in a country, whether or not there are what share merchandise exports form, as well as the share of agriculture, forestry, and fisheries in the domestic output. Moreover, it looks at the vulnerability, or actually a tendency towards shock, by measuring the instability of agricultural production and the overall export instability. So what we're looking at is a situation where the economic flows are unstable. This, of course, relates to the World Bank's concept, because I believe that it is, in fact, the instability of income flows that contributes to the challenge of developing capacity and delivering services. So clearly there are links, but I think that we have an advantage in looking at this more clearly economic measure related to the variability of flows when we're considering what the impact of the financial crisis is on fragile or vulnerable countries. And I hope that this might help us in developing some guidance in how to administer development assistance, how to focus it, and how to manage it. I think that the statistics that we've seen from Mr. Dix-Miro has indicated that there's been a tremendous shift in the direction of trade, as well as a change in the terms of trade. We've seen a significant rise and a more recent fall in commodity prices, and that is very relevant for many of the countries that are judged to be vulnerable, because many of them have commodities as a large share of their export earnings. Moreover, we've seen in particular the changes that the rise in the price of food and the rise, and more recently fall, in the price of fuel have had on individual developing countries. But one of the most important things that we mentioned this morning, that both of our speakers mentioned, is the growth in the importance of new trading partners, the change in the direction of trade, where Brazil, India, China, and Russia are representing a large share of trade. And if you look at individual African countries, in particular countries such as Sudan and Angola, who are exporting petroleum, you see that China has now emerged as the largest trading partner. It's not clear what this means in an atmosphere where it looks like the whole world is in turmoil. However, it has in the past proven to be very important if a country can develop diverse markets. If you look at the Asian financial crisis, Vietnam found its way out of trouble more easily than other countries in the region because it had a diversity of export markets. So that is something to keep in mind, although we may not yet know how we're going to get out of this difficult situation. Next. I'm sorry, you may not be able to see this, but this is a chart that was taken from the Accra Report on Aid Effectiveness, and Mr. Alfandari implied that he'd actually been working on some of these issues related to the Paris Declaration. And the Paris Declaration set up a new working relationship between donor countries and developing nations that are receiving aid, and in many cases where aid is a very large part of their fiscal revenue or fiscal accounts. And their number 7, the goal is to make aid more predictable. And they basically have looked at situations where that is the case in countries where aid has become more predictable. Unfortunately, it still remains a very small number. Well, it's some 40%, but the goal of 70% is looking not quite in reach. I don't want to underestimate the importance of that. We've made progress in other areas, but it's absolutely essential that we make progress in the developing a more predictable flow of financial assistance to the emerging markets, especially in the light of the comments about foreign direct investment, a source of income that is always considered to be more stable, but as Mr. Alfandari has warned us, is very narrowly distributed in the developing countries, and certainly among the fragile countries. So how will we get out of a situation of extreme stress? Because what we've seen, if we look at instability of flows as a measure of fragility, then we see that the countries risk becoming more fragile as a result of this current episode. And our goal, our overall goal, as those involved in the development process, is to limit fragility, not only because of the economic consequences that we've seen, but because we are well aware of potential political consequences. I spoke to Margaret Hayes when she came in, and I mentioned that I was thinking about her because she works on Latin America, and The Economist recently had an article that mentioned that 19 Latin American governments failed in the wake of the events of 1929. Now, of course, as she points out, they were more actively involved in the crisis. Nevertheless, the spillover effects of this current financial turmoil that may have started here, the spillover effects are significant, are worldwide, and are analytically significant in that they are calling into question economic models, are significant because they are involving all aspects of the credit market here. We're not talking about a bank problem or a capital markets problem. We're talking about a bank problem and a capital markets problem. And so there is a risk that it may take a long time as we learn to reprice risk. And I worked as a trader for a while, so we learn to reprice risk. And we go through what is now a very painful price discovery process until we've found an analytical grounding as well as some empirical evidence that we have a new framework on which we can judge the value of assets and an appropriate way to have a market for buying and selling those assets. So we need to recognize, I don't think anyone is being cavalier, but I think we do really need to recognize the risks that are involved, and we also need to recognize how important it is that we have a global solution, one that involves emerging economies and those who have not quite emerged to the market economy, but who are still a part of our world. We also need to measure the economic impact of the shocks, and I must commend the IMF for the work it did on the oil price shocks in developing a framework, a measure to say, well, the country has lost half of its reserves or has had a loss that's equivalent to 2.5% of GDP, then we have to think about an economic intervention to assist that country in meeting its own economic responsibility. We also have to go back to the old-fashioned way of looking at countries and assessing the sources and uses of funds. And one advantage of having been in the financial markets for more than 20 years is that I've lived through several crises. And whereas in the 1980s we had a real clear sense of you develop a table, you measure every single source of funds and use of funds, demand on funds of the country, domestic and international, we need to get back to that kind of basis, both in the public sector and in the private sector, as the private sector will now develop new approaches to country risk analysis. In the short term, and I've left out the short term there, we will need to develop some interventions that will help the countries to survive. And perhaps the most important will be to have a system to allow for trade credits. Now, in the 80s, there were fewer banks involved, and they actually sat down and made certain agreements that the short-term bank credit lines would stay open to the countries in Latin America that were experiencing payment difficulties. There needs to be a similar agreement that will keep those trade credits flowing. There's an extra challenge for the countries that have received debt relief because there's a wariness of having them take on any market-related debt. We'll have to come to grips with a way out of that to keep their exports going and also allow them to continue to import where they have the fundamental capacity. The IMF has its exogenous shock facility that has been revised. For whatever reason, countries have been reluctant to use it. We need to be sure that countries do make use of the facilities that exist. But perhaps most important, we need to increase targeted grants and develop a system, a strategy, as well as an implementation method of development assistance that allows development assistance to be predictable and to have a slightly counter-cyclical bias. Because right now, the reality is that when there's stress here, we pull back from foreign assistance. And that only exacerbates the pressures that developing countries are under. And I'm going to wrap up now, just mentioning the end states. We hope that we're in a crisis, but we have to still keep our long-term planning. We have to recognize that there need to be strategies to mitigate vulnerability. And that means, I've already mentioned, diversifying markets, but also having more productive agriculture. I've already mentioned the more predictable aid flows, and this should people at IDA 16 should certainly keep that in mind, but also the donors, whether it's the European Union or the individual bilateral donors, should keep that in mind and develop a strategy to meet that challenge. But most of all, we need to have better financial management. I was really shocked to see, when I read the Accra report on aid effectiveness, that accounting for bilateral grants is still incomplete, haphazard. When countries owe money to the African Development Bank, the World Bank, or the IMF, they always keep track of it. But it's not clear what happens in terms of accounting for either the receipt or the expenditures of grants. So that needs to be improved immediately. But we also need to consider one important issue that Mr. Alfandari mentioned, and that is exchange rate management. Recent economic analysis, including work that Danny Roderick has done at Harvard, but others have done in other universities, have shown the risk to all of the fundamental changes that occur when the exchange rate is overvalued. So we need to be careful that that doesn't happen, so that the countries are able to sustain their movement on the path towards both peace and economic development. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Melina, and thank you to two other panelists. I think we have about 20 minutes for questions, so I wouldn't summarize. I'll just open directly for questions. If you could make your question, comment, intervention very precise and to the point, we'll have an opportunity to hear from as many people as we could. Please identify yourself when you take the floor. There's one in the back.
Yes, Stu Callison, USA. Wilene, you mentioned that the IMF has developed some measures of the economic impact of external shocks like these. Is this a system that's available on their website?
Yes, I found from the IMF server, but I'm sure that Luis can point to more.
What we did,
exactly.
We produced two papers, one during the summer and then an update in September on the impact of the food and fuel price increases. They're both available on the fund's external website.
So they're papers, they're not ongoing?
They're board papers, but in terms of our relations, you know, we monitor these things, but you know, more on a bilateral basis. Every time a mission goes out, there's a re-evaluation.
Yes, you do. I guess the way Wilene said it, I thought maybe you had something there that you were tracking on
a day-by-day, month-by-month basis, but internally, obviously, each time.
But there was a first report given in the July 1st IMF survey that gives you the countries that will that they've identified and that they're focusing
on.
And then there was an update. So if you look at those two, but it provides this framework for the discussions with the countries. That's very important.
Thank you. Yes, please.
My name is Mark Castellano. I'm with the Government Accountability Office. There's been a lot of discussion about the IMF role in addressing the global financial crisis. And I just wanted to focus on the issue of conditionality. I don't know if Ukraine or Pakistan falls into fragile state category, but just wanted to get a sense for what conditionality will look like in this kind of environment for the emerging economies and how, if at all, it could be different from that of from the Asian financial crisis.
I don't know whether you want us to wait until the end to take all questions.
Let's take them as they come.
All right. No, I'm not trying to be evasive. I think in terms of the ability to respond quickly, I think you will see a differentiation in terms of conditionality depending on whether there's underlying structural problems that take longer to resolve and require some policy adjustments, as against things that are contagion, capital flight, liquidity risks, and the need for that is perhaps not as great. As you know, managing directors made various public remarks, general, vague, and until something is pinned down internally by our board of governors, that's about all I can say. But it is an issue of considerable debate in our executive board at the moment.
But would you want to hazard a guess, given what we know about the pervasive impact of the global financial crisis?
No, I would be inappropriate of me to second guess in public what the fund is might do. It's a very sensitive subject. There are differences of views amongst stakeholders.
Okay. Anyone else on the panel who might want to, just in broad terms, what should conditionality look like?
I mean, I can speak on behalf of the what we designed when we designed the low-income countries and the stress approach in looking at budget support. I mean, what I like is, I mean, you define it very well, the last two quintiles of the CPI in terms of performance, lowest performance, but low-income countries. So mm-hmm. we're not talking about the Pakistan or the Ukraine, right? What came out of brainstorming and board consultation, which I in 2001 and ended up in 2002, 2003 with the Likas paper, was that in the past, budget support was provided as a response to performance. And that's the very reason why we stayed disengaged from fragile states which became failed states, because we were not able to re-engage. So the new thinking was, well, performance, and that's true for fiduciary performance, is not a condition, it's an outcome. The idea was to put a limited amount of money, but in difficult contexts where you wouldn't have the fiduciary safeguards, but build them with programs to build up assistance and capacity so that at the end of your operation, you will make progress on the fiduciary and the other realization. And the reason why we designed that was the understanding that you don't build up the states if you don't have a stable political regime, and a stable political regime needs first to pay civil servant salaries, therefore needs proceeds. So we left the chicken and the egg story, right? Now, putting this back in the context of the financial crisis again, I don't think that banking regulation or market regulation is really what matters most to these countries, and it's not because they have poor banking or market regulation that they are fragile states. The fragility will come from more obvious things about the tax system, about corruption and that type of thing. And so all our programs are designed to try to help them improve these conditions, starting from a very, very low level, meaning that the outcome will not be as high than you would expect for other countries.
Thank you.
Thank you. Paolo Galli with UNDP. Looking in the near future, the summit on the 15th and the Financing for Development Summit at the end of November, the G20 or whatever it is in the Financing for Development, what does the panel hope that will be highlighted or decided upon in these two fora, these global fora, which I suppose that will have a beneficial impact on the whole framework, but in particular on these countries? And in particular, one of the panelists mentioned these new donors. I mean, how realistic do you think that you will have new donors? I think one of the gentlemen that seemed to suggest that you know, there was some optimism there that there will be, in fact, significant support by the donors under the circumstances. Thank you.
Willene, you want to go first?
Well, I think new donors are there, and I think new donors are very important for two reasons. Certainly at the African Development Bank, we have new donors who are from Africa. And having African countries step up to the plate, whether it's Botswana or South Africa, is important not only because of the funds that they bring, but because they're bringing insights into the development process itself. And so when China becomes a new donor, or when India becomes a donor, then one hopes that they have, with the grants or loans that they're giving, also some insights into how you might structure the programs and projects in a way that would lead to a transformation. Because clearly, China has undergone a dramatic transformation in the last 30 years. And so we hope we can learn some from that, while obviously being conscious of some of the risks that may have gone with the approach that was taken. But there's a need for a diversity of ideas in what we're doing in development.
Gil, anything?
Yeah, just very little to add. I completely agree with Mr. Johnson's remark. Donors are there. I think the question now is more about how we integrate them in terms of consultation and processes. As an example, I mean, about a year ago, our director for operation, Nick Cheyenne, was named in a special position linked to the Africa and the Asia region, looking at China and Africa. And most of his effort about the last year has really been to learn from the Chinese and share with them how we work on this type of development programs. How do we complement each other? In particular, if you look at the conventionality issues or the governance, obviously this is where we could have serious discussion about whether Chinese assistance would undermine our impact on the governance agenda. And the issue is still going on, it's not solved. But at the same time, and I know more about China than the others, so that's why I keep referring to China, but you mentioned many other donors and they're there. Chinese assistance in Africa is very important because they don't often provide the top technology, but they often provide the technology most appropriate to the means in the countries. When they invest in a dam or an official building, it's very often less expensive. Maintenance is easier and more appropriate to the local conditions. And there is also a transfer of know-how, which is extremely valuable. And what we see in the profession is the development of networks of professionals from these countries, which was not the case in the UK before. So the potential is there, it's acting, it's very huge. It's already making a difference. I don't know what will come out of the forum you mentioned, but I think that when the Bretton Woods Institution are discussing about giving more weight to what we call party countries, that's where we're leading, basically. So it's a more integrated decision-making body eventually. It won't be easy.
Let me just see, how many more questions do we have? We have one from Philippe, one from Margaret. Any more? Okay, why don't we just take the two and then we round up.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Philippe Duplante from Eurasia Group. I had a question pertaining to Africa, might pertain to other regions as well. Gilles, you'd mentioned that in the Central African, West African CFA zone, you have a peg currency. And I know this was a big issue back in 98, so I'm wondering 10 years later, you know, how do you look at peg currencies, let's say in the African context, versus those that are floating and in many cases doing quite poorly, whether it's the rand, the Kenyan shilling, the Ghanaian cedi. So maybe you could give us your take on that.
Hi. Margaret Hayes. Willing, you mentioned the Latin American debt crisis and all of the crises subsequent. And my question to all of you would be, are there lessons from these that we ought to note and avoid or reorient in dealing with a potential crisis? Now, in the Latin American debt crisis gave us the Washington Consensus and a number of other things that focus mostly, I think, on fiscal and management and not on issues like agriculture and education, and certainly didn't have to deal with the challenge of the food and fuel crisis, which obviously is going to be a continuing challenge in this adjustment. So are there issues that are relatively clear about things we ought to do in dealing with, or that we ought to do in dealing with this crisis that come out of those experiences?
Okay, I'll invite responses and concluding statements from the three panelists. So we'll start with you, Louis.
Yeah. Let me take the Latin America question. If you're talking about the fragile states,
mm-hmm.
The impact of the global financial crisis, I don't think requires interventions and a change in the policy mix in the fragile states themselves, because they're not really integrated. They may rely heavily, such as Haiti, on remittances, but you know, it's not a question of redressing a financial problem within those countries. I think, you know, the lessons that we've learned over the last few years, or been reinforced, is the need to sustain capacity building and technical assistance, predictability of budget support. It's very hard to manage budgets and delivery of services when you're not quite sure what's coming. And I think, unlike perhaps Julie, one of the issues for the fragile states in the coming year is going to be the volatility of export prices, which will significantly affect the volatility of fiscal revenues. And this is no small issue. You know, you look at, say, Cote d'Ivoire, cocoa, 80% of export revenues, a major source of fiscal revenues. You take Burundi, Rwanda, the same, but in this case, coffee. One thing is the need for contingency planning. This involves addressing priorities. And that's particularly difficult, especially in those fragile countries where it's the political situation that's fragile. Cote d'Ivoire, it's very difficult in the current environment, even though they have a strong technical capacity. And you know, expectations are always a problem. Well, not a problem, they're understandable, but they have to be managed, because you know, you supposedly resolve a conflict and
I'd love to take that as a former exchange rate manager.
Okay. All right.
The first thing is, it's hard to, you were implying that those with the floating rates, such as the RAND, we're doing awfully badly, and I'm not sure that's the case.
A lot of them certainly are. In terms of depreciating, that's all.
But you're really talking about the non-fragile countries.
Yeah,
that's the point.
And part of the reason that it's non-fragile is that it has... The market is able to assess the value of what it's producing and makes an adjustment in its exchange rate that is consistent with that. It may not be minute by minute exactly the right rate, but it's consistent with moving a country towards equilibrium. And it need the situation in the CFA countries. Yes, it's a pegged rate, but it need not have gotten so far away from what would deem to be an equilibrium if certain other countries in the world were doing better financial management. And having started my central banking career in the time of the Louvre and Plaza Accords, there was a time when the major economies recognized that it was very important for them to move towards balance in their external accounts. It's not just something that an adult developing country should be doing. It's very important that we in the developed world recognize that our imbalances have an impact on our own country, but also on the rest of the world. So I don't think it's the regime itself, but it's how it may promote or impede the adjustment process that most of us are concerned about, and there's room in both, if economics is well managed, and that's the big if that we're not living up to right now, that we've got to do. I thought, Margaret, we've already recognized in terms of what have we learned. We've learned that the case-by-case approach doesn't work. Maybe we learned it a little bit late, but I think we clearly have learned that. And the idea of taking a national approach for the U.S. and now more an international approach for everyone is a good sign that we recognize that this is a global market and we have to deal with it responsibly in a
which
global
probably
fashion.
Was less so in 1980s.
It took us a while to get there.
Yes, very briefly. On the exchange rate, it's easy. We leave official assessment of exchange rate regime to our colleagues at the phone. Just to remind, it's a tremendously complex topic. First, the fixed exchange rate system in Africa has brought stability and success in the fight against inflation. Every finance minister will fight really hard in favor of that system. Still, it has hampered in recent years with the weakness of the dollar competitiveness. And I agree with you, I'm not sure it's because the system is fixed. Maybe the peg is weird. Why peg Africa to 100% euro basket when basically its price structure is half dollar and half euro, or maybe 10% even yen? There's many ways to do. Then there's the question of the optimal currency area. If we're back to the fragile states story, let's think about the Central African Republic, which is part of the Central African French zone. That's the only non-oil exporting economy in a monetary union where they're all oil exporting. So is it an optimal monetary currency area? I don't think so. So there's really a lot of issues here. Clearly, for many countries in the past year, the weakness of the dollar was a problem because basically the proceeds of their export fixed in dollar conversion to euro did not bring sufficient fiscal revenue. And, again, we're back to the position of the exchange rate about a year earlier. These questions are in the air, and I don't know how they're going to be solved. The traditional answer is this country needs to strive on improving competitiveness to overcome this appreciation of the real effective exchange rate. To the extent it's sustainable. On food and energy, the only thing I'd like to add is I don't think the response is very different from fragile states and developing countries. The means is different, but basically what we're doing at the bank, on food and energy, looking at Africa again as the area in which I work, develop capacity, supply capacity, and develop networks. The problem in Africa is that you have so many places which have supply excess in so many countries which are not producing energy, and connecting them to continental grid can decrease energy costs significantly for some of them. And it's true of fragile and non-fragile states. Obviously, you need public financing for that. It's not easy. On agriculture, the focus, until last year, we at the bank had focused our action maybe a bit too much on export commodity and not enough on domestic
food consumption. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think President Zelic is really put the emphasis back into domestic food production. So you know, working both in emergency with distribution of seeds and fertilizers, but then longer term in terms of really improving domestic supply and encouraging farmers for domestic markets. And here again, I don't think there is very much difference between fragile and non-fragile states. The question is one of capacity, both financial but also the know-how and the people there who know how to implement this type of program.
No, thank you very much, Gilles, on a very forward-looking note. And thank you very much to Louis and Yulin for sharing so much with us, and to you for participating. Thank you.